So first of all, let me thank Michelle for giving me the opportunity to speak here. My name is Yuan Wan, and I'm a postdoc at the Perimeter Institute. So as David already mentioned, I'm going to talk about spin on dynamics in quantum spin ice. So our results are already published, and I welcome you to read this paper if you're interested in knowing the details of my talk. My collaborators are Juan Carrasquilla, who is also a postdoc at the PI, and Professor Roger Melko, who is both faculty at Perimeter and a faculty in the University of Waterloo. So I know that today it's pretty late, and I guess many of you are tired. But the story that I'm going to tell you today is both simple and short, and I hope I'll keep you entertained. So Jeff already gave a very nice introduction about spin ice physics, but it doesn't hurt to remind ourselves about what exactly a spin ice is and why it's interesting. So briefly speaking, spin ice is essentially a frustrated ferromagnet. So the spins form a so-called pyrochore lattice, which is essentially a network of corner sharing tetrahedra. So every side is occupied by a spin, and every side is shared by two tetrahedra. The crystal field effect is such that spins are forced to point from the center one tetrahedra to tetrahedron to the other tetrahedron. So there are only two ways to go for the spin. Before we move on to talk about the lattice, let's first look at tetrahedron. And we have four spins sitting at the corners of the tetrahedron. And we can ask what are the ground states for this simple object. So remember, we're dealing with ferromagnets. So what does ferromagnets do? The interactions in ferromagnet dictates that we want to maximize the total magnetization as much as possible. So ideally, we want to make sure that all the spins pointing up in the same direction. But you see that this is impossible because remember that the spins have to be pointing in those special directions. So you can convince yourself the best you can do is to have a configuration where you have two spins point toward the center tetrahedron and two spins pointing away from it. So this is the so-called two-in-two-out state, and you see the overall magnetization is going up. So this way, you can minimize the energy. But you immediately see that this is not a unique choice because we have such a high symmetry, so you can find five more states in which the magnetizations are going down or going to the right, to the left, point out of the plane, or point into the plane. So there are six states, ground states, per tetrahedron. And we already have quite a lot of states for a single tetrahedron, and the entire lattice is a network of tetrahedra. So you see that the ground states, there are going to be many, many ground states for the entire system. So as a matter of fact, the number of ground states actually is an exponential function of the number of spins in the system, so which is very different from the conventional ferromagnet that we know and love, where we have only two possible ground states, namely going up or going down. So much about ground states. So how about excitations? So remember that to minimize energy in a tetrahedron, we just need to make sure we have two spins pointing into the center and two spins pointing away from it. So this is the rule for minimizing energy. So to create excitations, we simply violate this rule locally. For instance, we pick a tetrahedron and we let three spins pointing away from the center and one spin point to the center. So you see that we violate, and as a result, we actually create a point defect residing inside a tetrahedron. Likewise, we can have three spins pointing and one spin point away. We also create a point defect living inside tetrahedron. So remember that we are only violate this ground state rule locally, so the energy cost is actually finite for having for creating a single point defect. As a matter of fact, if you do a simple math, it turns out it's actually half of J, where J is nothing but nearest neighbor ferromagnetic exchange interaction energy. So what are those point defects? So remember, in ferromagnetism or in magnetostatics, we have a concept known as a magnetic charge. So magnetic charge is nothing but the source or sink of the H field, the macroscopic magnetic field. So we can think of this tetrahedron as a surface. We can actually compute the total magnetic charge contained there. So if you look at the ground state tetrahedron, you see there's no magnetic charge sitting inside. However, for this particular one, we have a negative charge sitting inside the tetrahedron, which means that this is actually a sink of this H field. And likewise, for this particular configuration, we have a positive charge sitting inside the tetrahedron, which means it's actually a source of the H field. So you see, those point defects are nothing but actually magnetic charges. Or put in another way, those point defects are nothing but the north and the south poles of this ferromagnet. So you see that because we have finite energy cost to creating one of those magnetic charge, and we can place them randomly inside the lattice. So you already see that in this quantum in spin ice, we can create as many north and south poles as we wish, and they can be anywhere in the system. Moreover, you can actually move, if once you create, say for instance, a north pole, you can actually move it around the lattice along a string of spins. As you move along as you flip the spins along the way, you can actually move the north pole from this side, this tetrahedra, to this tetrahedra, and you repair the tetrahedra along the way. So not only that, there are many of them that can be created at your will, and also they can actually move around inside the lattice. So you see that the excitations in the spin ice are nothing but the poles, and the north and south poles are can be thermally created, and they are mobile, so which are very different from the conventional ferromagnet, where the position of the poles are completely fixed by the geometry or shape of the magnet. So much about the classical system. So let's move on to the quantum spin ice. So in simple terms, quantum spin ice is nothing but just classical spin ice with lots of quantum fluctuations. And because we have quantum fluctuations, so the spins can flip with the help of quantum mechanics, and the magnetic charges they can actually tunnel from one tetrahedron to another tetrahedron. So that means the classical magnetic poles or magnetic charges are promoted to quantum particles or quantum objects, which are known as spinons. So here, hence the title of my talk. And as I mentioned, the magnetic charge, we know that in a ferromagnet, the magnetic property is controlled by the location of those poles. So we see that in spin ice, those spinons or magnetic charges are responsible for many of the physical properties of those systems. So it's actually very important for us to understand how exactly the spinon or spinons propagate in the system. Or to make things even simpler, let me ask, how does exactly one spinon move inside the lattice? This is sort of a minimal situation that I want to investigate. So before I move on, let me just mention that there are lots of candidate materials for a quantum spin ice system. And Dr. Halas actually mentioned quite a few in her talk. So as Tolstoy once said, all happy families are alike, and each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. So all of those materials have its own problems that make them far from being ideal. But I'm going to focus on the ideal situation. I'm going to look at happy families. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to find a minimal model that is as simple as possible, my spherical cow, that actually captures the most vital or essential feature of the dynamics of spinon. So to actually build a model, let's first look at how exactly spinon moves in the system. So let's first zoom on to a single spinon in the lattice. So as I mentioned earlier, for this positive charge spinon, it violates the two in, two out rule. So we have three spins coming in, one spin going away. And for the rest of the tetrahedron, we have two spins pointing in and two spins pointing away. So those are vacuum sites. So let's try to first, so because we have quantum mechanics, so the spins can flip. So let's first try to flip this particular spin. If we flip this spin, as you see that the original site is actually repaired because we have two spins pointing in and two spins pointing away. and the spin-on or this positive charge actually hops to this labeling site. So the one lesson, the first lesson that we learned is that if you want to hop the spin-on from one side to its neighbor, we have to flip the spin that is connecting those two tetrahedra. But remember, we have not only those incoming spins, we also have this outgoing spin. So let's see what we can do. What will happen if I flip this outgoing spin? If we do this, we see that we actually do not move this spin at all, and instead we create more charges nearby. Remember, every charge comes with a finite energy cost, and if the energy scale of the quantum fluctuation tunneling is much weaker than the energy cost for creating those guys, then we can completely forget about this process. And as a result, we see that the spin-ons move in a very strange manner, which, namely, the spin-on has to follow, has to move against the directions of the spins. So it can't go this way. And likewise, if you do the same analysis for the negative charge monopoles or spin-ons, you see that they have to move along the direction of the spins. So with those lessons that we learned, we can immediately write down a minimal Hamiltonian that captures this kind of dynamics. So here we only have spin-ons hopping, so I and J are labeled tetrahedra. So the spin-ons hop from one tetrahedra to its neighbor. And for this positive spin-on, it has to move against this direction of spin, which I show it as a graphic as an arrow. But for this negative charge spin-on, it has to move along the direction of the spin. And no matter what you do, if you want to flip spin-ons, you always have to flip the spins along the way. So this is the simplest possible model that captures this interesting feature of a spin-on dynamics. And I have to emphasize that this is not my model. Actually, the model was originally proposed by Lars Anslinger and John Nagel in 1974 in the context of proton transport in water ice. And last year, this model and many ideas are actually revived by Olga Petrova, Roderick Mosner, and Shivaji Sondhi in the context of quantum spin ice. So even though this model looks very simple, but I have to emphasize that it's actually a very challenging problem to solve if you want to solve the model analytically. Because the first thing you observe is that if you scale the hopping amplitude to 1, there's no free parameter left. So that means the model is intrinsically non-prohibitive. Second of all, even though we have only one object in the system, namely in the spin-on, but it's still a many-body problem because don't forget, we have lots of spins inside. So it is still a many-body problem. So why this problem is hard? Because we have a chicken and egg problem. So as I mentioned, the motion of the spin-on is they obey strange rules. So the positive charge spin-on has to move against the direction of spins, and likewise, negative charge spin-ons have to move along the direction of spins. That tells you the background spins, they are not just spectators. They are actually guiding the motion of spin-ons. However, remember, the spins, when they move, they also flip the spins along the way. So that means whatever spin-on does, when it travels around the loop and revisit a side that it was before, it's going to see a very different local spin environment. So on the one hand, we have spin configurations control the motion of spin-ons. On the other hand, we have spin-on motion scramble the spin background. So that's why this problem is challenging. However, if we ask less ambitious questions, instead of trying to fully solve the problem analytically, let's ask less ambitious questions, then we can actually make progress. So for instance, there's a very, very simple observation that allows you to write down the ground state of this seemingly simple Hamiltonian. I'm going to skip the technical details, but if you believe me, then the math basically tells you that the ground state has a very special structure. It's basically an equal amplitude superposition of all possible spin background arrangement. So even though it's a superposition of all possible states, the spins are not free. Remember, we have only one spin on inside lattice. So in the tetrahedra with the spin on, we have three spins pointing, one spin pointing away. for the rest of the lattice, the spins have to obey the 2-in-2-out rule. So even though we have an equal amplitude superposition of various configurations, but the spins are not completely free. That's the one point that I want to emphasize. So with the knowledge of the ground state, when we can study the dynamics of spin on top of this ground state. So to do that, we need to find a good observable to characterize it. So I choose a particular correlation function, which is essentially the, in many body physics, essentially known as a density-density correlation, but in this context, it's nothing but position-position correlation. So I call it CIGT. So what does it measure? CIGT measures something like this. So suppose at time zero, I observed a spin-on inside tetrahedral I, then this CIGT measures the probability of observing the same spin-on inside a different tetrahedral J. So you see that this quantity indeed just characterizes the propagation of a spin-on inside the lattice. So we can actually re-express this correlation function as something that a theorist is more familiar with namely a path integral. So I'm not going to tell you how I derive this, but I'm going to tell you what this mathematical equation means. So remember, the ground state has many, many different spin configurations. So we just pick one, let's say alpha. So in this spin configuration alpha, let's say the spinner wants to propagate from one side to another side, then it can go through all possible paths, which I label as gamma, and the weight for each path or whorl line is weighted by a simple kinetic factor. This is not important. The important thing is that for a given spin configuration, not all of those paths are allowed. So let me explain what I mean. So for instance, in this case, the spin-on tries to move from this tetrahedral or this side. So sorry, before I go on, I forgot to mention that now I'm just showing everything in 2D because I reached the limit of my visualization skills. So the spin-on just trying to move from this side or this tetrahedral to another tetrahedral, and it goes along this direction, along this way. So we know that this is actually okay, because if you observe the direction of spins along the way, they are all pointing toward the origin. So remember, the spin-on moves against the direction of spins, so that means the spin-on can indeed go along this way and flip all the spins, and whereby reaches the destination. So this kind of whorl line is indeed allowed in this configuration alpha. So however, there are some other paths that are not allowed. For instance, in this case, the spinner wants to make a loop, travel around the loop, and you see this is not allowed because some of the spins are pointing in the wrong direction. So the bottom line is, if you take a spin configuration alpha, then not all of those paths are allowed, only some of them are actually allowed. And you take this alpha, you sum over all of those possible paths and their contributions, and then you simply average over the spin configurations. So that's the meaning of this path integral. Even though this is intuitively simple, but we can't really do much with this. So remember that we really don't care so much about spins in this problem. We really care more about the motion of spin-ons. So the best thing we should do is to trace out the spin degrees of freedom and keep the spin-ons. So this indeed can be achieved. So there is a simple mathematical trick where you can simply switch the order of summations. So remember, originally, we first take a spin configuration, sum over all the allowed configurations, passes, and then average over them. So instead of doing so, we can do this. We fix a whorl line or a pass, and we ask what kind of spin configurations are actually compatible with this pass. So put another way, we ask what kind of spin configurations in which this pass is feasible. So if you do this, then in the end, we actually simplify simplified expression, and we add, but the price to pay is that we have an additional weighting factor W gamma. So what is W gamma? So W gamma simply counts for a given whorl line or given pass gamma, the number of spin states for which gamma is feasible. So, and divided by total number of available spin states. So you immediately see that both actually are essential entropic factors. So you can interpret this W gamma as a weighting factor as the entropy cost for this pass gamma. So in the end, you end up with a simple expression in terms of only spin-down world lines and with this additional weighting factor, which encodes all the interactions. And as I said, this W gamma is just an entropic factor. So you can see that all the self-interaction is actually entropic in nature, which is very unusual for me. And you can ask, with this W gamma, you can ask, you know, what are exactly its implications? So first of all, we should figure out what kind of passes are actually allowed in this case. So for obviously, the spin-down can propagate along the way. However, when you try to make the spin-down move in a loop, you are going to have problems. Because in this case, the spin-down move along around the loop and revisit the site and try to traverse a link in the same direction, and you see that's impossible. Because initially, the spins are pointing this way, and the spin-downs travel along, flip all the spin along the way, and you see that this particular spin is actually point away from a spin-down. So you see that this kind of motion is forbidden. So there are some hard constraints on the kind of passes gamma that are allowed. Another interesting implication is that because this W gamma is entropic feature, actually that implies the motion, the spin-down motion is actually self-retracing. So I'll explain what I mean. If you compare two passes with the same length, naively for a free particle, they're going to have the same contribution. However, in this case, because these are spin-downs, so when the spin-down move along this simple trajectory, we have to make sure that in the initial states, these spins are pointing in this particular direction. However, in this case, the spin-down revisit or retraces passes several steps. So it actually visit fewer or traverse fewer links. So as a result, in the initial states, we just need to specify fewer spins to make this walk or this pass feasible. So put another way, even though they have the same, so to recap, even though those two passes have the same length, but the number of links they traverse are different. So this one traverses fewer links. Remember, if you traverse fewer links, you have to fix fewer number, the orientation of fewer spins, and there you are going to have more initial spin configurations that are compatible with this pass. So therefore, this kind of walk is more likely than this one. So retracing is always preferred because the self-interaction is entropic in origin. So I'll skip the how do we actually estimate this interesting weighting factor. Just direct jump to our results. So we have a simple walk problem. So we can just put in a computer and simulate it. Remember, in a computer, you can't really deal with real time. You have to rotate everything to the imaginary time. And in the imaginary time, the problem really just become a diffusion or self-interacting random walk problem. When you have a self-interacting random walk problem, the first thing you measure is the so-called mean displacement square, which is roughly speaking that how far this walker travels for a given amount of imaginary time tau. So you see that this quantity quickly approaches linear behavior. So if you quickly approaches linear behavior, you know that actually the spin-down is doing nothing, but roughly the spin-down motion is roughly diffusive, or simply just a simple random walk. So if you see a diffusive behavior in imaginary time, then you can actually rotate everything back to the real time, and realize that actually that means in the real time, the spin-down just propagate as a simple massive free particle. As a matter of fact, the diffusion constant you extract from this plot is directly related to the real time the mass or the inertia of the spin-down. So if you fit this into a linear curve, you can extract effective mass, and in my unit is 0.25 to 1.51. You can compare it to the mass that you would have for a free particle without any interaction, and you see that it's significantly heavier than a completely free particle. Which makes sense because, after all, the spin-down is actually not moving in a vacuum. It's moving inside a bunch of spins. I'll skip this part. So to recap, so as I mentioned, we studied a toy model describing the dynamics of spin-down, and as emphasized, it's actually a strong coupled model to begin with. But remarkably, this dynamics has a renormalization phenomena that actually, in the end, if you look at low energy, the spinner really behaves as a nearly free and a massive particle. And also, because the spinner walk is self-attractive or self-retracing, then the mass is heavily enhanced comparing to its free counterpart. And I'll conclude here.
Questions? Jeff?
So how much of the ice manifold does this particle explore? Like how, if you just let it walk for an infinite amount of time, what fraction of the?
Oh, sorry, let me first. Oh, you mean the, yes. So you can actually show that if you have two particles in a periodic lattice, it's completely ergodic, so.
Right, but if you have one, you don't have loops, right? So I'm just wondering what.
With one?
If you're talking about one, right?
I'm actually talking about two, because you can't have one in a periodic system.
But you don't let them come near each other?
Sure, but you can still show that it's ergodic.
So it's still ergodic if you're not able to flip loops?
Yeah.
OK.
Yeah, actually, yeah, it's ergodic.
Additional questions? OK, I've got one very quick last question before we wrap up. So there's this linear behavior, the numerics have a slight break from that at low imaginary times. Is there anything to that, or?
Yes. So actually, this deviation at short time from linear behavior tells you that, or if you look at the slope quickly goes down. So this deviation from the linear behavior tells you that. The motion is actually self-attractive. So one way to think about it is like this. So remember, the spinner wants to retrace the places it visited before. So initially, when the motion just started, the walk just started, every side is equivalent. So the spinner can visit is pretty much a simple walk. So after a while, some sides are visited, some sides are not, and it prefers to go back. So it sort of drags down the propagation diffusion a little bit. So that's why the slope goes down.
Okay. Any additional questions? If not, let's thank Yuan and all the speakers.
Okay, I think that concludes corners for this year. So thank you very much for, first of all, the two keynote speakers who traveled a long way to come and give a talk today. So let's thank them.